Order.
The fortnight's adjournment, coinciding with the school holidays, ended at 2 on Tuesday with this announcement from the Speaker, David Carter.
Honourable members, I wish to advise the House that I have received a letter from Kevin Haigh resigning his seat in the House with effect at midnight on 6 October 2016.
Kevin Haigh was a List MP on the Greens benches since 2008. He had already left the building, having delivered his valedictory last month. His replacement off the party's list, Barry Coates, was in the chamber on Tuesday, ready to be sworn in.
I, Robert Barry Hobson Coates, solemnly, sincerely and truly declare and affirm that I'll be faithful and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, her heirs and successors according to law.
And Barry Coates outlined his ambitions as a lawmaker in his maiden statement before the dinner break on Wednesday.
The golden thread through my career has been a passion for sustainability and social justice. It has led me to the Green Party and now into this House. I've achieved change from outside politics, and now I want to achieve change from within the political system. I feel a strong sense of urgency.
Unfortunately, there was none this week. While Barry Coates maintained the Greens' muster at 14, the total number of MPs in the House fell by one to 120 with this announcement on Thursday from Mr Carter.
Honourable members, I wish to advise the House that I have received a letter from the Honourable Phil Goff resigning his seat with effect from Wednesday, 12 October.
Mr Goff's departure from Labour's benches on Wednesday appeared to have gone unnoticed there, requiring this request the next day from their chief whip, Chris Hipkins.
Mr Speaker, I seek leave to correct Labour's two votes at the committee stage of the Agricultural Compounds and Veterinary Medicines Amendment Bill yesterday, when 32 votes were cast instead of 31. I think the member casting the votes is still grieving that announcement, but the correct number of votes at the time should have been 31.
Phil Goff was an electorate MP, and his departure creates a vacancy in the Mount Roskill seat, which has to be filled by the winner of a by-election. That leaves the opposition one short of a majority to support members' bills until after Saturday, December the 3rd, the date of the by-election announced by the Electoral Commission on Tuesday, which was the day that Mr Goff said goodbye to the debating chamber, where he had sat on both sides for some 30 years as a backbencher and a minister.
It was some 35 years ago that I first stood in this House. I was actually elected 6 months before I gave my maiden speech, because it was the tradition in the Muldoon years that Parliament was not called for 6 months after an election. I would not encourage the current government to consider adopting that practice. I looked back at my maiden speech and I thought that with experience and with changed circumstances, many of the policies that I have pursued over my time in this House have changed. But what I don't think has changed are the values that I pronounced in that very first time that I stood up in this Parliament. That, I guess, was reinforced by my Catholic upbringing. It was reinforced by excellent teachers that I had at school, paid tribute to my old school, Papatoetoe High School, that working class kids went to and got the best education they could ever have hoped to get. I was also inspired by a young guy that was flatting with my brother, Warren. And at age 16, halfway through my last year in what was then called the seventh form, I was not so politely asked to leave home by my father. We still argue about this, and we're probably going to meet halfway, that it was partly his responsibility and partly mine. But that young man was a guy called Mike Moore, who went on to become Prime Minister of this country and Director General of the WTO. So I had good role models. Another role model was my predecessor as the MP for Mount Roskill. His name was Arthur Faulkner. He was a Spitfire pilot during the Second World War. He was an excellent local MP, serving Mount Roskill for 24 years. He was a decent and capable man, and he taught me much about politics. 2.5 years after I succeeded him as MP for Mount Roskill, the then Prime Minister, Sir Robert Muldoon, called what
became termed the Schnapps election. We've all seen the photographs. We remember the clips on television, and Don McKinnon still wonders why he was standing behind the then Prime Minister while those famous shots were taken. But I remember gathering that night upstairs in the Leader of the Opposition's room, David Longy's room, and the palpable excitement that we felt that there was going to be change in New Zealand and we were going to be part of that. I was privileged to be elected by my caucus to Cabinet in 1984 at the tender age of 31 years, which I think still makes me the youngest Cabinet Minister in New Zealand's political history. It was young, and I was young, and perhaps that was an advantage. I didn't know the constraints on ministers. The first thing I did as Minister of Housing was unilaterally stop the sale of state houses. And a triumvirate of finance ministers, Cagle, Preble and Douglas, came to see me and say, "Do you know what the fiscal implications of your announcement is?" I didn't, and I wasn't I wasn't concerned about that, but I was pleased at what I did. I said we were excited, but our first cabinet meeting was before we were sworn in. We were briefed by Rod Dean from the Reserve Bank and Bernie Galvin from the Treasury. And I remember that excitement subsiding as they told us what the state of the country's books were. We were broke, and there were really tough measures that were going to be needed to rescue our country from bankruptcy. And I remember grimly thinking, this is going to be a one-term government. In the event, it wasn't. We took the hard decisions, most of them, I believe, right, some of them wrong, but we were rewarded for our courage with a second landslide victory in the 1987. The excitement of that election did not last long. I remember running into Roger Douglas in January. I was still in the habit of coming back early from holidays thinking this is a really important job, I need to be behind my desk. And Douglas saying to me, "I got a letter from the Prime Minister." And I wondered, why would the Prime Minister be writing to the Minister of Finance? That government, which started with so much promise, ended after the collapse of the share market and with the disunity that marred the second term of that government. And that is a lesson for any government in this country. Just reflecting on the portfolios, my first portfolio, I think your first portfolio is like your first love, with respect to my wife sitting in the gallery. Not quite as good as your first love is what I should have said. I have had many portfolios, but I've only had one wife. And she'll be pleased to know that.
Get your way out of that, Mr. Boss.
I diverge, Mr. Speaker. What I loved about the housing portfolio was that I believed that you could make a tangible difference in people's lives, and I hoped that I was able to do that for many families that we were able to help. There are other portfolios where I also felt that working together with a group of other people, we were able to make a difference. And making a difference is what is really important when you come into this house. That's what all of us want to do. You don't always go along with public opinion. I remember when I became the first Environment Minister, and very soon after that, an organisation called the DSIR, Department of Scientific and Industrial Research, put a report on my table. And that report said that within a matter of months, the Pahutu geyser at Whakarewarewa would collapse. And it would collapse because the residents and the commercial establishments had all decided that having cheap energy was really great and they would sink bores quite close to it. I was appalled at that thought and worked remarkably with Peter Tapsell and Bob Tizard, and we made the decision to close those bores within a 1.5 kilometre radius. I think if I'd gone to Rotorua at that time, I would have been lynched by the locals. But today,
that geyser is still there. That geyser was there for me to take my kids to and will be there for me to take my grandkids to. In 1999, Helen Clark appointed me to two portfolios. One was the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade and the other was Justice. They were a curious pairing of portfolios. Prime Minister, if you want to keep a minister busy and keep them out from under your feet, that's probably a very good thing to do. But I relished both of those portfolios. I look back at some of the legislation we passed over that time. There was the Bail Act, the Sentencing Act, the Parole Act, the Victims' Right and the Clean Slate Acts. And some of those were laws that were tough laws, but I believe that combined with addressing the causes of crime, they contributed towards making our community a safer place. Foreign affairs and trade were quite different portfolio. They were stimulating, they were fascinating. We had the challenges quite early on in our time of 9/11, and I remember 9/11 well. I habitually went home about midnight, got taken home by our VIP service, and I'd been in bed for about 20 minutes, and I got a call from my driver. He said, "Minister, I think you should go downstairs and watch the television." And I thought that was a kind of a very strange thing to happen at 20 to 1 in the morning. But that was a scarring experience for the whole world. And I remember the dramatic nature of what happened and the decision that we made shortly thereafter that we would need to commit our soldiers, putting them in line of duty at risk because of the threat that Al-Qaeda posed to the world. I remember the Boxing 2004 tsunami. Mary and I had decided we'd stay home on the farm rather than going away those Christmas holidays. And I remember building a structure out in the front of the farm and getting the telephone call. And I remember the dramatically awful experience of going to a place called Khao Lak, north of Phuket, and going to a temple that was a morgue for several thousand people who had been dead and exposed to the sea and the sunshine for about 8 days. And I remember the huge admiration I had for the disaster victim identification team, our New Zealand police officers, who did a job that I am just amazed that they could have stomached for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. The smell, the sight, and the taste of death is something that will always remain with me, but equally, so too will my respect for those people who served our country so well. I said before I was proud that we made the commitment to Afghanistan. I was equally proud when we made the decision not to commit to the invasion of Iraq. We believed that it was a poor decision, that it was ill-founded, that it was a wrong thing to do, and I believe that decision by the Allies has led to the appalling situation that we face in the Middle East still today. And I was proud that this country stood up, was independent in its assessment and its delivery of its foreign policy, and we were right. Finally, Mr. Speaker, while I'm leaving here, you have not, I promise, seen the last of me. It's a deep honour and privilege last weekend to have been elected with a strong mandate to serve my city of Auckland as its mayor. It's a city I love. It has a stunning environment. It has a richness of cultural diversity. It offers the people that live in our city choice and opportunity. It makes up 35% of our population, 37% of our production, but more than half of this country's growth. Auckland is our country's international city. By attracting and retaining the talent and enterprise New Zealand needs to progress, it serves New Zealand as a whole. For New Zealand to succeed, Cabinet members, this will not be the last time you hear this, Auckland has to succeed. I look forward to working with the government and with all members of the House to challenge the problems we all know about, the worsening traffic congestion, the housing unaffordability, that stand in the way of Auckland achieving for New Zealand and itself what we as a country need it to do. Mr. Speaker, this is an adversarial chamber. However, I believe that members elected to this Parliament all want to make this country a better place. I thank you all for your friendship. I thank you for indulging me today as I've reflected on my time in this Parliament, and I wish every one of you well for the future and farewell. Thank you very much.
Labour's Phil Goff leaving to take up his new role as the Mayor of Auckland, where he was first elected to Parliament, winning the Mount Roskill seat in 1981, and going on to become a minister of some 20 portfolios and leader of the opposition. His success in last weekend's local body elections was just one of several that set his Labour colleagues crowing in Wednesday's general debate.
The National Party got smashed in Auckland. Absolutely smashed in Auckland.
Labour's Palmerston North MP Ian Lees-Galloway in full crow and a chorus choir that included their Mount Albert MP David Sheeran.
It was a great weekend last weekend with a rout right across the country. In Auckland, Wellington, Dunedin, even in Whanganui.
Then a twist of the knife from Labour's Shadow Attorney-General, David Parker.
Now, we know in history that Tories, particularly in the UK, they actually, many a Tory loves a good thrashing. just not in public. But last weekend, they were thrashed publicly, sir, by voters across New Zealand.
Across the chamber, National's Chief Whip Tim McIndoe was unfazed.
Mr. Speaker, I love hearing the Labour Party trying to cheer themselves up. They've had more leaders than we've had hot dinners. And if they want to look at the local body elections over the last weekend, the reality of the matter is that there's actually been very little change. More to the point, let's look at Phil Goff. There he is out there campaigning with blue hoardings because he didn't want to be associated with red ones.
National's Chief Whip Tim McIndoe, while the ghost of Phil Goff continued to haunt the chamber, his name on the tip of the Prime Minister's tongue when Mr. Key rose to answer this question from Opposition Leader Andrew Little on Wednesday.
With only 18 affordable houses sold to first home buyers, developers pulling out, land bankers sitting on sites instead of building houses on them, and a minister incapable of doing his job, isn't it now just time to admit that National's flagship housing policy has been a complete and unmitigated disaster?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, in answer to the last part of the question, no, it's not true. In answer to the first part of the question, it's not 18, but even if it was 18, it'd still be five times as many people who voted for Phil Goff to be, voted for Andrew Little be the leader.
Mr. Key's Deputy and Finance Minister, Bill English, did have some good news for the government, elicited with the help of this question from National backbencher David Bennett on Thursday.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance. What reports has he received on the Crown finances?
The Honourable Bill English.
Well, Mr. Speaker, some surprisingly good reports. Today, the financial statements of the government were released for the 15-16 year. They report a surplus of $1.8 billion. This is $1.2 billion higher than was forecast in the budget just a few months ago. Revenues were about $1.6 billion higher than forecast, and expenses $600 million lower than forecast in budget 2015. Total Crown assets have now increased to $293 billion, the highest ever. And the government is on track to reduce debt to 20% of GDP.
Finance Minister Bill English, who, as the Minister responsible for Housing New Zealand, had this response to opposition claims on Thursday that the corporation was going broke.
It's ridiculous. Just ridiculous. There is no reason to believe that Housing New Zealand is under financial strain, going broke, and it's absolutely nowhere near collapse.
As for a similar claim from Labour's housing spokesman Phil Twyford.
No, Mr. Speaker, that's a ridiculous assertion about Housing New Zealand. But, and I know that that won't stop the member making it, vigorously, no doubt. But it's just verging on stupid, actually.
Order. Now from the debating chamber to the committee rooms with Rhys Lyon.
Members of the Health Committee, who met on Wednesday for public submissions on former Labour MP Marion Street's petition on euthanasia, heard a harrowing story from Brian Wright Vangen, a Polish immigrant who, as an 18-month-old, was sentenced to hard labour in a Siberian prison.
my parents, six of us children, my grandparents, my uncles and aunts, their children, and we were all deported to Siberian slave labour camps. They all perished, 19 of them, including parents and grandparents and uncles and aunts and first cousins, 19 of them. By age six, I had seen everything, too much of everything, including death. I was even on a heap of bodies. It's one of my worst nightmares. And then I was grabbed hold by somebody who said, he's alive, he's alive. So I am a realist.
Mr. Wright Vanjen said that realism shaped his stance on medically assisted dying.
Every day it happens in our hospitals. Okay, let's leave it alone. That's very wise. Suicide, people have a right to their own life. No, if a person wants to do it, fine. But to insist that a doctor assists, that's another... Oh, no, no, that's not fair to nobody.
A later submission came from Louise Forsyth, a palliative care nurse who disagreed with the official stance of the body governing her industry, Palliative Care Nurses New Zealand. While the organisation had submitted in opposition to the legalisation of euthanasia, Louise Forsyth was in favour of it.
I personally have discussed the subject at length with many of my palliative care colleagues, and they believe, as I do, that patients should have the right to choose if they have a medically assisted death.
Ms. Forsyth also spoke as the daughter of parents suffering from dementia.
In their increasingly rare and more lucid moments, both my parents regularly state that they wish they could die. It is truly horrendous to watch two beautiful people who were highly intelligent, articulate and dignified lose all of their former selves and become angry, aggressive, fearful and totally dependent on caregivers to meet their needs. Personally, I believe that medically assisted dying should become legal in New Zealand.
Louise Forsyth with that submission on former Labour MP Marianne Street's petition calling for an inquiry into public attitudes towards euthanasia. The following day, the Primary Production Committee heard submissions on a bill updating laws around food safety, including one from food writer Anna Tate Jameson, who said new food safety compliance costs resulting from the bill would adversely affect artisan cheesemakers.
We're the world's leading dairy exporter. Milk, butter and cheese, it's how the world sees us. And yet our food safety laws make it nearly impossible for our artisan dairies to operate. If you listen to the submissions today, you'll wonder how these businesses make any money at all. I believe we're reaching a tipping point. By trying to eliminate risk, we risk losing the artisan sector.
Or put another way, by cheesemaker Biddy Fraser-Davies.
So small operations finish up with a product no one can afford except wealthy gourmets at high-end restaurants and Government House.
Anna Tate Jameson called on the committee to consider the bill's effects on small cheesemakers.
I'd ask you to put yourselves in the shoes of small businesses who want to create new products and try to strike a balance between the need to minimise risk and the need to create an environment that fosters the sort of innovation that will add value to our most important primary industry.
Food writer Anna Tate Jameson with that submission on the Food Safety Reform Bill, which is due to be reported back to the Chamber by February the 16th next year. Later on Thursday, the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee heard submissions on the bill overhauling the government's spy agencies. Calling in on the select committee he served on for 12 years to make a submission on the Security and Intelligence New Zealand Bill, former Green MP Keith Locke voiced concern at the bill's apparent change of mandate for the Government Communications Security Bureau, or GCSB.
To me, it's very disappointing. When I was in Parliament on the debate on the GCSB bill in 2004, we were never going to use the GCSB to spy on New Zealanders, and Speaker and Minister and after Minister spoke in that vein. Now it's open slathers, the other submitters have indicated.
Mr. Locke said government-approved surveillance should only be used to monitor criminal activity, not political dissent.
That's the experience I had when I got my SIS file and 2008, covering 51 years of surveillance. There was not a single indication of criminality. It was all about politically motivated surveillance. That is, I was dissenting against the government on the Vietnam War, on apartheid, on nuclear issues, on human rights issues, and this was the reason given for the surveillance of me. Nothing to do with criminality. And this system here, based around non-criminal national security issues, enables that to continue.
Former Green MP Keith Locke with that submission on the Intelligence and Security New Zealand Bill, which is due to be reported back to the Chamber by February the 18th next year. In total, there were 23 committee meetings held during the week.
That report from Rhys Lyon. Back in the Chamber, talk of elections continued with the first reading of the Electoral Amendment Bill, making some relatively minor adjustments to the Electoral Act, ready for the next general election due in 2017. The debate on Tuesday included this contribution from Labour's Chief Whip and Shadow Leader of the House, Chris Hipkins.
Mr Speaker, listening to the debate so far on the Electoral Amendment Bill, I can't help but get the feeling that there's a little bit of fiddling while Rome burns going on when it comes to this debate. This bill makes a number of technical amendments to current electoral law, while the huge elephant in the room is the declining level of participation by the citizens of this country in their democratic process and the dwindling levels of confidence in the institutions of our democracy, whether that be this parliament or whether it be the electoral system or whether it be just wider scepticism about the whole of government and the whole of the governing process. We're seeing that much more visibly in other countries than we are in New Zealand at the moment, but we are not immune to that here in New Zealand. And if we want to see indicators of that, let's start with the number of people who aren't on the electoral roll, who are quite significant, and then the number who aren't voting. Combine those two numbers together, Mr Speaker, and the second runner-up at the last election wasn't actually us in the Labour Party, it was that group of people. It was the non-voting group of people who actually came second. The non-voters party came second at the last election. That's something that none of us in this House should take any pride in. And I have to say, we are here debating the rules by which we are elected, and I'm willing to make a wager right now that there will be very little public scrutiny of this debate. It won't get covered in the media. It will not be on television. It will barely be covered on any other form of media. And yet we are determining the rules by which we get elected, by which we then have the authority to make the laws of this country, and no one is scrutinising us. And that's something that we should be concerned about, because what we have seen over the last decade or more is a diminishing of the fourth estate, the media, and the role of the media in scrutinising what we do. The fact that we are changing the laws around elections with no scrutiny is something that we should be concerned about. And the fact that most New Zealanders now will be getting information about politics and about the electoral system through non-traditional media, things like social media. And the problem with that is it encourages people to live in an echo chamber where the only views that they get are ones that they already have, and their existing views are reinforced, and they're not actually exposed to alternative arguments and debate. And I think that that's something that we should be really concerned about. And of course it relates to this, because when we're talking about low turnout and we're talking about people not being on the electoral roll, all of those things contribute to that. And so here we are debating a whole lot of technical amendments, but we're missing that wider picture. My colleague Jacinda Ardern talked about the importance of civics education, and I absolutely agree with her on that. But I would go so far as to say that the entire New Zealand curriculum is actually civics education, because the single most important thing that we can do is encourage young New Zealanders to be critical thinkers and to question everything that is put before them.
Labour's Chief Whip Chris Hipkins, speaking in the first reading debate on the Electoral Amendment Bill, which was sent to the Justice and Electoral Committee for public submissions. And the House passed 23 bills this week, which is a lot, although they all came out of the Judicature Modernisation Bill, itself a product of the Law Commission's review of the 108-year-old Judicature Act. And now for the week ahead, here's the Acting Leader of the House, Chris Finlayson.
Mr Speaker, when the House resumes on Tuesday, 18 October, the Government will look to complete the first readings of the Outer Space and High Altitude Activities Bill and the three Regulatory Systems Amendment Bills, and to progress a number of other bills on the order paper. Wednesday, of course, will be a Members' Day.
Acting Leader of the House, Chris Finlayson, and I'm Tom Frewin, and this program was made with funding from Parliament.